You're quite lucky, actually. This dinner went perilously close to being, I think, probably a very full audience. When Susan and I were emailing the original title of this, as happens when the sort of you're typing out emails, that wound up being built to service. And it occurred to me that's a very different concept to being built to serve. About 10 years ago, Jeremy Rifkin wrote a book in which he argued that a shift was taking place in the way that the economy and society was organised, and there was a move away from ownership and towards buying access. So instead of needing to own commodities and needing to own real estate, what increasingly business was seeking to do was to ensure that it had access, and that particularly in an information age, gave you a great deal more flexibility and an opportunity to add value to a much greater extent. It seems to me that PPPs are part of that same part of that same trend. PPPs are temporal rather than material. They're, instead of about commodifying places and things, which was very much what government did during the industrial era, from the middle of the 19th century to the until the last couple of decades, government is basically buying access to time and expertise. Now, that illustration there is of a PPP, a very large PPP in the UK for air-to-air tanker refuelling, which the military put out. They're still negotiating after about 3 years. They're still negotiating the contract, but this is a huge, monstrously large PPP. And essentially what the military did was to buy a quantity of fuel in terms of altitude, latitude and longitude. They were buying the aircraft that carries the fuel is owned by the private sector. It can be leased into the commercial market when it's not required by the defence forces, and essentially what the military's buying is we need this aircraft to be available at this altitude, this latitude, this longitude, at this time, with this amount of fuel. It's essentially where it's going. There are a number of implications of that. Firstly, I want to suggest that PPPs are a service industry. It's very easy, particularly when you look at something like a bridge, to think that PPPs are about something physical. You know, the first of those bridges was the Glenfinnan Aqueduct, which some of you who've watched Harry Potter movies will recognise. The second one was the Sydney Harbour Bridge. And, of course, this is the wonderful Millau Bridge in France. It's very easy to get obsessed with the physical object, particularly something as magnificent as that. But, in fact, bridges are essentially bundles of services. Because unless somebody takes the concrete, the stones and the steel and does a whole lot with them, they just sit at the side of the river or the harbour. They don't do anything. So to a very, even something as sort of obviously physical as a bridge or a road requires civil engineering, it requires project financing, it requires project management, it requires facilities management. And with toll roads, it requires somebody to actually go out there and manage and interface with the customer and manage their expectations and understand the way in which they relate to roads and the way that you pay for roads. I delivered a speech in Sydney when I was out last year asking why aren't we selling the Sydney Harbour Bridge overseas. All of those services are capable of being sold overseas, and of course when it comes to toll roads, we're actually having remarkable success at selling a number of those services overseas. This particular bridge, in fact, is Waterloo Bridge in London, which was built in the 1820s as a private toll bridge, to show you that this is, in fact, a very old tradition. In fact, just to show you how much PPPs are part of our culture, in the English-speaking world, that's a Constable painting of the opening of Waterloo Bridge, a private toll bridge. And there are a set of wonderful Monet paintings done around the turn of the century which feature this private toll bridge. PPPs are very much part of the fabric of our culture and our the way we see the world. Secondly, PPPs are about integration. Integration of service design and building design, integration of design, construction, finance, maintenance and operation. Integration that is much tighter than the kind of integration that you have when government does this through traditional means. And the reason for that is that risk has been transferred, and if these things don't hang together in the right way, then the consortium, members of the consortium are going to be paying for it. Now, of course, if we put the boundary in the wrong place, then we increase fragmentation and we create perverse incentives. So we need to think about what services are to be included. We need to think about what this piece of infrastructure is meant to do. We need to think about that at an early stage. We need to think about the partnerships, and that's a good part of the reason why we use the term partnership in public-private partnership rather than privatisation, because the boundary lines matter. Thirdly, service design lies or ought to lie at the heart of PPPs, no matter who does it, no matter who does the service design. This is... Some of the comments that I'm just about to make come from a piece of research that we did at the Serco Institute last year in response to a Treasury consultation. Treasury had put out a paper identifying a number of issues associated with PPPs. One of the concerns that they raised was that so-called soft services weren't necessarily delivering the same value for money as hard FM, hard facilities management, and the building. I have to say their evidence for that, in fact, was extraordinarily thin. But the way the Treasury, when they sort of set up their internal review, the way that they were thinking about this was that as they conceived it, you built a building and financed it, and then you sort of plugged services on the side. And working through the Confederation of British Industry, we tried to get across to Treasury that that's the wrong way of thinking about it, that you've actually got to start by working out what it is you want to do with your services and then build your building around that. And we were largely successful, I'm pleased to say. What we did in the Institute was to go to a number of our people who've worked, because we're a service company, worked in the design of PPPs from a service perspective to unpack what's going on. And they told us, I mean, essentially, I've sort of broken this down into four things that explain the benefits, and I'll come back on a couple of these. Firstly, that you're designing for delivery, that if the service provider is intimately involved in this process, then you're sitting there and thinking, what function is this going to perform and how do I optimise the physical design so that it enables me to do the maximum that I can with the services. So that's sort of feeding forwards. Coming back the other way, the service provider owns the design. So there's no point sitting around complaining about how this building or this facility works. You were involved in it. You had a chance to have your say. Get on with it. So that a whole lot of that sort of risk shifting, that cost shifting, that blame shifting is gone. You were part of the team. You've got to now work with what you've got. And unlike a consultancy, and apology to any consultants here, but the difference is that here you're warranting the outcome. So this isn't all care, no responsibility. If this service design, if this building design doesn't work, you're going to pay for it. And you've warranted to the customer that this is going to work. And finally, if the customer gets it right, then there is a license to innovate. I'll come back now on just a couple of those. From a service provider's point of view, this sort of seems obvious. I mean, you don't have a hospital for its own sake or a laboratory, for scientific laboratory for its own sake. You have this because you want it to actually deliver services. So there is sort of, you know, this is sort of seems self-evident, and yet it's amazing how within government so often this thinking is quite fragmented. So that we ought to be talking about infrastructure services, not just infrastructure. And it's interesting, you know, Transurban in their literature talk about infrastructure services. We don't need the infrastructure in and of itself. We need what the infrastructure enables us to do. Now, in fact, this is an old idea. These here are designs of prisons from the 18th century. And there was a period of considerable innovation and experimentation in prison design and in prison service delivery. It was a period when criminal justice was dominated by prison reformers, John Howard and the like, the other John Howard, the one who was promoting prison reform, and Jeremy Bentham. And they paid a great deal of attention to the way in which these facilities were designed. This one here is just a little blurry as it comes up here, and the grey one behind it are in fact of Panopticon, which was designed by the great utilitarian philosopher Jeremy Bentham and his brother. It was never built, but it dragged on for about 20 years. It was sort of one of those PPP projects where the poor guy sort of spends years investing in it and then government finally walks away. Bentham's proposal was that he would build this very, you know, modern design, built out of steel and concrete and glass, with speaking tubes, you know, I guess the equivalent of two, you know, what you'd have now with telephones or something. This is all in the late 18th century, let me remind you. And he was going to build it himself, and he was going to operate it himself. And the result of all that work, in fact, is the earliest sophisticated analysis of contracting. The origins of contract theory come out of the work that Jeremy Bentham and his brother Samuel Bentham did on this project. So this is an old idea, this close integration of service delivery and service design and building design. It was fundamental to what he was doing here. Interestingly, one of the best case studies that we have of this designing for delivery point comes out of the prison's experience particularly in the UK, to some extent here as well. It has, I think, been the market's been deeper in the UK and it's been better studied. This picture here, in fact, is of the Wolds, as it's known, the first privately managed public prison. It was actually a publicly built facility and privately managed. It isn't PPP, although the designers were actively building in a whole lot of the thinking from the private prison industry as this was being done. It was sort of operating in parallel. And this is radical stuff. I mean, any of you who have sort of seen even a fragment of Porridge or one of those English television shows will be sort of familiar with the landings concept, where you have these sort of, you know, two or three levels of prisons with no public space and just with the landings out in front of the cell doors. This was radically different in that where you see that little brown desk there, that's the prison officer. And the other space is where the prisoners mix. People over in the corner aren't prisoners. This was the day it was opened. So that's a bunch of suits wandering around. As you can see, that's a radically different concept. And it grew out of, interestingly, some innovation that was done by the Federal Bureau of Prisons, where architects and psychologists and prison managers were working closely together to think through a completely different approach to the way prisons were run. And they decided, instead of leaving prison officers outside a metal or glass barrier, perspex barrier, they would put them in the middle and have them intimately interacting with the prisoners, working with them, helping them to through their problems, helping them working through their various education and health programs. And the theory was that the result of that would be that tension levels would be lowered, and therefore you a whole series of things would flow. You'd have better relationships. You would actually need fewer staff, and so on. They tried to pick up those ideas. That was sort of the early 1970s. In the early 1980s, the Brits tried to pick up those ideas and transport them across through a couple of different reports, and they failed. And it was only when this began to happen that the private prison industry picked up that revolution that had taken place in the States and transported it. And that's pretty much happened here. Barallon in Queensland was instrumental in importing the first of that thinking here in a significant way. Now, the result of that was that, this is one of the prison officers, the result of that was that they wound up not with a very, not only just a radically different design, buildings that physically looked different and had, and where associational space was defined in different ways, but the service that went with it functioned differently as well. This was one of their prison officers. Again, this was radical stuff. Not wearing a military uniform or a militaristic-looking uniform. Wearing a blazer with a name tag. The prison officers, this is 15 years ago. The Prison Officers Association to this day will not allow the government to have insist that it's that it, the prison officers in the UK, in the public prisons wear name tags. From that very first prison, they began calling prisoners by their first name. 15 years later, a very small number of public prisons are prisoners called by their first name. And so it went. There was this revolution in the way in which prison officers related to prisoners. And this very interesting balance between, on the one hand, needing to be firm, but on the other hand, trying to seek to befriend and work with them in working through an active regime to be busy all day and to work on their drug program or their education skills or whatever it was. So this was a, you know, this is sort of a classic example and a striking example of a revolution that occurred because of the introduction of prison contracting and then very soon after this, PPPs. And the first, there were two PPP prisons done at the same time. And I'd hasten to say this isn't our prison. This was actually a Group 4 prison. We had the second of the privately managed public prisons. Group 4 also got one of the first two PPP prisons. And they had this debate. I've spoken to the architect, who was an American, who was responsible for importing this thinking across the pond. And I've spoken to him about the introduction of what's called unit management and direct supervision, or dynamic security in the UK, into the UK through this process. And asked him what that process was like. And he said, you know, at Old Course, for example, we had a debate about whether we were going to put carpet on the floors because it costs more money. He said, we won that one because the argument was carpet lowers noise levels. If you lower noise levels, then the prison officers don't have to speak as loudly. And when you've lowered their voice, then you've sent a very different message in terms of the interaction. The person who's in charge is speaking with a higher voice. It's sending some very different messages about the way in which this relationship's going to operate. He said, I didn't win on space. He said, we are half won. He said, I would have liked more space at Old Course, the first of these first two PPP prisons. He said, we wound up having to compromise because more space means more cost. So there was this very interesting debate and dialogue going on that involved this struggle to optimise design. When we were doing this project, I sort of set this up and had one of my staff doing the detail. But when I sat down in the early stages to sort of talk through with some of the people who've worked on our prison design, they used interesting language. They started talking about flows, and they weren't conscious of what they're doing. And I sort of stopped them and said, "You're using interesting language here. Just take me through this." And what they were doing was looking at a block of land, the envelope within which we're going to deliver this prison. They then said, what kind of prison is this? Is this a local prison, in which case the families are going to be coming and visiting, so we need to think about visiting space? Or is this an industrial prison, so we're going to have lots of commodities, trucks with goods in them crossing the border? Or is this an educational prison, so it's largely self-contained, but we're going to have quite a bit of free movement within the prison because people are going to be going to and from classes? So what's its function? What's the space we're working with? And therefore, what are the flows going to be? And how do we design this in order to optimise the design of this? Because flows mean either if they're crossing a border, security risks, or they mean having numbers of prison officers accompanying people as they undertake those flows. And all of that is crucial if you're wanting to. 80% of operating costs of a prison are personnel costs, because, as you can appreciate, it's a very people-intensive business. So to the extent that you can get down your staff-prisoner ratios, you can massively reduce your costs. I mean, by the way, it was all of this was hugely successful. Just to sort of in parentheses, construction costs on construction times on PPP prisons fell 40%. Construction costs from the first PPP prison to about the fifth one, 3 years later, which was the cheapest, was 38%, and that was already on top of a cost reduction of about 15-20% for the early privately managed public prisons. The benefits that came out of this were immense, and quite apart from the cost savings, the government introduced what they called their decency agenda. This was the sort of wedge that enabled them to get the decency agenda into the public system. And they've been successful to some extent in spreading that elsewhere. Now, the other side, one of the other themes that I mentioned there was innovation. And if the customer does this right, and it does depend heavily on how the customer approaches it, there's an opportunity for significant innovation in the way services are delivered and the way in which the building is designed. This is a Serco one, and it's broken some new ground. It's literally, we've just probably only just broken the new ground. It's being built at the moment. This is a hospital, as you might gather from the title, Forth Valley. It's in Scotland. And the customer asked us to think about movement, flows of people and goods, and to try to separate out some of those flows. One of the things, and this has been developing for some time, a desire to keep anyone who doesn't need to be going through clinical space out of clinical space. If you're trying to avoid the spread of disease, it's pretty important to actually keep, you don't want your administrative staff wandering through that space. So, in fact, on a hospital prior to this, we'd sort of separated the levels so that the administrative staff have different lifts and different floors. In this one, we've got them in a different building. The customer had asked us, in the interest of dignity, to separate visitors from patients. So we have different lifts and different parts of corridors, so that, you know, that sort of unseemly appearance that you have when you go to hospitals of people in their gowns wheeling a trolley with a drip on it as they go off to radiology. And we arranged to separate out into different lifts and different corridors the movement of goods, the movement of linen and food. And because we'd put them into a separate corridor, we're able to move things 24 hours a day, and we're able to use robots. Now, that doesn't look much like a robot. It's actually being guided by... there's several different systems, and we haven't decided what we'll use, but this was the most likely one, sort of electromagnetic signals and so on. And so we can move that 24 hours a day. We move clinical waste in that way. Non-clinical waste actually is just put down chutes, so that we can get things that are smelly just off the floors immediately, so that the area where sick people are is as clean and as fresh as we can possibly get it. And whereas before, our porters were basically big hefty guys who didn't have great people skills, because they've got these things, we can now spend more time concentrating on making sure our porters have got people skills, because they're going to be spending much more of their time moving people than they are moving food or linen. So this was a case where the customer asked us to do something radically different. We came up with something very innovative. This is the first time in a British hospital that robots will be used, and already... I was in Berlin about 3 weeks ago and ran into one of our competitors who's bidding on a prison that we're not bidding against them on that one, and they've actually already tapped into this, and they've picked the idea up and they're building it in as a key part of their bid, with some refinements, with some further, some better sophistication above and beyond what we've done. I want to suggest that there's a fourth kind of a benefit that comes from this focus on services, and that is that we face the possibility of developing radically different kinds of public services. That if government is prepared to step back and allow innovation to occur in and around service design as well as building design, we have the prospect of doing things in a very different way. Let me argue by analogy to just, I guess, push the edge of the envelope a little in closing. This is a Danish company called Falck, who run 80% of their ambulance services and 60% of their fire services in Denmark. So if you're reading a Danish paper or looking at a telephone book, you'll see the 112 emergency services number, the equivalent of a 000 number, and then after that you'll see Falck with their number. This is a private for-profit company. They have done this for about 80 years. And in fact, it was the socialists who gave them their leg up when the socialists got elected in the 1920s. Why was that? Well, because the socialists, because fire services and ambulance services are delivered at local government level, local government had no intention of handing any of these functions over to the national government. That's something we all recognise from Australia. The socialists wanted to radically improve the quality of fire and emergency services and professionalise that, but there was no way local government was going to cooperate in any way that gave national government more power, and the socialists could see that they were prepared to deal with Falck, so they assisted Falck, and at that point it had a competitor, in going in and contracting with local authorities in order to professionalise their fire services. Der Altid means always there. Their slogan is always there. And let me just explain what always there means. I'll start by showing you a cartoon that they put out some years ago. This is just delightful. Because you'll see, down here somebody's fallen in the fountain and Falck has turned up with an ocean rescue service to pull people out of the fountain. Over here, you can see this. There's some couples canoodling, and the Falck people have very nicely stepped in and put screens round to just privatise them, and so on. There's a fat bloke fallen over here, and they're rescuing him. The concept that's underlying that is that Falck doesn't just provide fire and emergency services. It provides ocean rescue. It provides roadside rescue. It provides farm rescue. It provides contents. At a fire scene, it sort of will act to protect your property and or the neighbour's property in order to minimise insurance costs and so on. They provide a service that is a completely different combination of emergency services to one which we see in this country. They provide a combination of free public services with subscription services, roadside rescue. And several years ago when they had some heavy fog and a huge pile-up with hundreds of cars on the motorway, Falck was offering an integrated service that was addressing fire, roadside rescue, towing and ambulance services in a combined way. It's a radically different way of approaching this and not a way that, to my knowledge, any country where government delivers these services has combined these services in that same way. There's some other examples that I could give of that. Point being, it seems to me that government has the opportunity, if it's prepared to think about these things, the provision of public infrastructure services in a different way, and invite the private sector to be innovative, not only in the way that it designs the physical infrastructure, but in the way that it designs the services, either on its own or in cooperation with government, then we have the possibility of seeing public services that are delivered in radically different ways. One of the most interesting examples of that in contemporary times is what Transurban is doing with toll road management. They, because we are being charged to use their roads, and because they don't offer cash as an alternative, they've had to pay a great deal of attention and they've done a lot of research to try to understand the way in which different people relate to roads and relate to paying for roads. they've had to go out in the M7, the experience of the M7 compared to the Cross City Tunnel in Sydney is a classic example. In the case of the M7, Transurban were out there months in advance talking to local businesses, talking to local stakeholders, getting them to buy into the road and to buy various access ways of getting access to the road, so that those sort of issues had been resolved and addressed long before the road was ever built. Now, you think about the last time when government treated you as a customer on the roads. It's just, you know, we're talking about a radically different a way of approaching our roads. It happens in that case because we're paying for it, and because in order to get people onto its roads, Transurban has got to pay a lot of attention to the way in which we relate to roads. They're doing really interesting work around sort of road architecture, the way in which roads are designed, and the road furniture, I think, is the term that they use, the way in which they're addressed. And the airport link in the airport motorway in Melbourne, you'll see a number of examples of that road furniture, those big zippers that you, as you come into Sydney and then into Melbourne, and then as you sort of go around past the docks, there's sort of various covers and so on that have been put in, partly in order to address local noise concerns, partly in order to address, in order to just simply make the journey an experience that has been punctuated in various ways so that it's somewhat more interesting. That's a radically different way of thinking about it. And it's happening because governments here approached the involvement of the private sector in the construction of these new toll roads in a radically different way. We're way ahead of the world still. And Transurban, as a result of that experience, is off in North America teaching the North Americans about a completely different way of thinking about roads. All of that, I understand, is some distance from where governments are here in Australia. And I think it's going to take us a little while to get there. The experience from the UK, I think, is that over time, government relaxes on these things. I think there is a need to address some issues, some union concerns. I think the industry needs to be much more sympathetic to those concerns. If we're interested in an industry that's going to be around for the long term, then it's important that those concerns are addressed, that there is bipartisan support, and that the strong opponents, that their arguments are muted, that their arguments are softened so that they don't win ready support with the public. There is a need for the industry to take a long-term perspective on these things, to think well beyond the current government, to think well beyond the current set of issues, and to lay down a regulatory framework and a policy framework for this industry that will see it here in 20 years' time. I guess I have some concerns that with the undue focus that there has been in the PP industry in this country up until now on the financial engineering aspects of this, as important as they are, that the service engineering side of this hasn't perhaps not received sufficient attention in this country. I think that the PPP schools is one of the places where we've begun to see, in this current generation of PPPs in Australia, we've begun to see that shifting, and part of the reason why there is so much interest amongst Labor governments around Australia in PPP schools is because the New South Wales experience was a good experience for teachers and head teachers, not just because it saved money. I should stop at that point and allow you to challenge me and contest me on some of that. The message I would want you to walk away with is to think infrastructure services. Think, you know, as an industry, as government officials, we're not there simply to build roads, we're not there to build bridges, we're not there to build prisons. We are there to provide services that will deliver to the public. And the contribution that we from the private sector can make to that is much more than simply building some well-financed facilities. Thank you.